Before the podcast, we've got a favour to ask. We're trying to find out more about our listeners and would like your views about this podcast series. Please go to edrsurvey.com/BBCsurvey or find the link in the show notes of this episode. Thanks in advance for your help.
This is the BBC Academy podcast, essential listening for the production, journalism and technology broadcast communities. Your guide to everything from craft skills to taking your next step in the industry.
Welcome to the Academy podcast with me, Charles Miller. Today, we're going to be separating the hype from the reality around virtual reality, VR, and its simpler and cheaper cousin, 360 video. A recent report by PwC predicted that by 2021, there'll be 16 million VR headsets in the UK. That's up from just 2 million today. But what will persuade so many millions to join the VR revolution? The BBC's already produced a range of experimental VR and 360 projects, from news to factual programming, history and children's. Beyond the BBC, and indeed beyond the media, VR is being used in areas such as training, product design and marketing. So if you want to jump on the VR bandwagon, what are the opportunities? How should you position yourself and your organisation to take the lead in this new field? To explore all this, I'm joined by two senior people from BBC Research and Development. Zilla Watson is an editor who's been responsible for a number of VR projects at the BBC, and Sai Lum is a senior product manager in BBC R&D Future Experiences team. And to talk about the prospects for VR in the wider world is their former BBC colleague, Rebecca Gregory-Clark, now the lead technologist for immersive technology at Digital Catapult, a government-funded agency that promotes technological development in the UK. Well, welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, not everyone will have had a chance to try out VR 360. So I'm going to ask each of you to give us one example of something that you've experienced which really made you think that this is going to be big in the future, just to give us a flavour. Becky, would you start with that?
Okay, it's difficult to answer. I think partly because there's been such a variety, and that's part of the reason I think there's so much promise for it, because I've seen different, really exciting things in different areas. One of the my favourite things still was from last year. It was called Notes on Blindness. It was a brilliant piece, a documentary style piece about a man who lost his sight, and it was narrated with his real words from documenting his experience as he went blind in his 40s. And the visuals that went with it were fantastic. But more recently, I spent about an hour inside a Star Trek experience with somebody else who is on the other side of the world as well. And that was just great fun and actually a good reminder of how much fun the VR space can be as well.
Sorry, I wish we had VR because you're up in Manchester and we're in London, so we can only hear you. But what's been your most powerful VR experience so far, do you think?
I think I'll go back to when I started making a fuss at work about VR. I was very lucky in that I was invited to see the HTC Vive headset before it was commercially available, and it was the first headset that I'd tried that you could walk around in VR, and that changed everything. I came back and I'm sure Zilla and Becky can attest, I didn't shut up about it for years, because it was just that ability to step into another place, feel like you were there, and look underneath or behind something. There were a variety of experiences I tried. I think Tilt Brush, which is a painting experience from Google, was one of the more impactful ones and still is. But it was just that ability to take a step into a space that your eyes and brain felt was pretty real, that meant that there was something more than 3D TV to it that warranted further investigation.
I think there have been a lot of reports that when people are sceptical about VR, they stop being sceptical as soon as they've experienced it, and that the only way to sort of persuade the doubters is they put the headset on and they emerge enthusiastic. Zilla, what's been your sort of evangelical experience?
I was lucky enough to go to Stanford to their VR lab, and I did the most classic VR experiment there, which is the pit one, where you are standing in front of a giant pit before. And this is the thing that can convert any skeptic about VR and make you realise that it can really affect the way you think and feel. So this giant pit meters and meters deep, opened up in front of me, and they got great sound there as well, so they managed to open it up with a sort of huge clash, and I had to walk a plank across it, and I was absolutely terrified, and you buckle and your heart goes, and when you do something like that you really realize the visceral power of this medium and how different that is from television or radio.
Yeah, I've done the walking the plank one, and I must say I was really, my heart was beating and I was really scared, just like you're scared in a dream when you sort of somehow know it's a dream but something frightening is happening.
Yeah, and you remember it as a very physical memory as well, which I think is very interesting. It's not just going on in your head, you feel it in your body when you remember it.
Wizzilla, I'm going to ask you to start explaining the sort of VR landscape, because you've just completed a report for the Reuters Institute about the use of VR and 360 video in news. And the most widely distributed examples are, in a way, the least sophisticated, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, I interviewed over 20 news organisations, and most of them are doing 360 video, probably mostly intended to be watched on a phone, which you can move around. It's called a magic window, so you move your phone around and see the pictures all around you, or in a browser. But that's not really VR, which does need a headset to make it fully immersive. It's described by many as a gateway to VR. It's certainly a gateway to VR for production because it's easier to produce. Whether it actually will encourage more people to want to view the real thing, I think is we've yet to see.
So Becky, can you just explain to me the difference between 360 and VR? If I put my headset on, how would I know whether I'm watching VR or 360 video?
Well, a 360 video is filmed with a 360 camera. It points in every direction, and you won't be able to interact typically. So you'll see what looks like a real scene. You'll be able to turn your head, but you won't be able to move within that space in the room that you're in, and you won't be able to interact with anything.
It's just like a film.
Just like a film, but in every direction. Whereas virtual reality, because it's sort of created in a different way, it means that you can interact. You can usually walk around. You can affect things that happen in the scene, so it will be different if you watch it again and again.
Like a video game, in fact.
A bit like a video game, exactly. Yeah. And in fact, that's why they are made with the same, some of the same technology, like a game engine, for example, is this kind of software that you use to create these virtual worlds, and it's a very similar technique.
So, Sai, I wonder if you could just do the sort of technical thing for us.
Sure. VR itself typically demands a more highly spec'd phone or a much more highly spec'd computer, and you're really running more of a game, and that game is giving you these dual eye views to give you a much more immersive experience.
So in general terms, 360 video is sort of cheaper and simpler, I guess.
I think it's easier to get into. I think Zilla's absolutely right. If you're a broadcasting organization used to video broadcasting, moving to a different form of video is a transition that's probably easier to make. You have the equipment, you have the lenses, you have these kind of things, and your expertise is about positioning a camera in a scene. The virtual reality that's based on a game engine, you need to have made games. You need to be using something like Unity or Unreal, these game engines that power the consoles and video games in people's homes and on tablets. And that's a whole journey of skill set and talent and expertise that that not everyone in the broadcast industry certainly has invested in over time.
Becky, can you just give us an idea of the sort of range of uses? I mean, we're interested in the media, but there's a lot more than that, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, the creative industries generally have a bit of a head start where it comes to VR for a lot of reasons. But even within that, the people who are working on it come from all sorts of different backgrounds, media organisations, games companies, visual effects, film companies, all have different skills that you need and actually sort of converging in a quite an interesting way. But they're using it for all sorts of different applications in the creative industries. But then even wider than that, we particularly look at manufacturing and health applications at the Digital Catapult. And we're seeing really interesting uses of it in product design, training, data visualization applications. And in health, it's been used, and there's actually quite a wealth of academic research on this over the last 20 years or so, for various different kinds of things like surgical training, visualization, or even in treatment and rehabilitation or clinical psychology.
So are we still really waiting to see whether it'll be the media, which is the area that that VR takes off in. It could be something completely different, perhaps.
Absolutely. I think at this point, it's all to play for in a lot of ways.
So, Zilla, coming back to the sort of BBC and the media in general, how realistic is it, do you think, that a mainstream audience is going to be immersed in VR in the near future?
Well, I think if we're talking about high-end VR, I think it is going to take a while. And we have to accept that the higher-end equipment will be bought by early adopters first, but you've just got to accept that this is a technology that offers enormous potential, and over time we will learn and adapt to it, and indeed the technology has to progress a long way before it become mainstream, but it may well do one day. So I wouldn't say that, oh, this is never going to happen, that people will never be watching the news on headsets. I mean, they probably won't on the headsets we have at the moment, but once VR develops, and there is no question that it is going to be part of our lives in the future.
So, Sai, in fact, your job title is to do with looking into the future. What's your take on that?
The work I do at the moment is really, you know, I've worked on VR for over 2 years and looked at where augmented reality is going to go and looked at
what's
next.
Augmented reality?
So you'll hear AR as the buzz term. Augmented reality is, there's something called the mixed reality spectrum. Virtual reality is predominantly virtual, as in it's all generated by a computer, so none of it is real, if you like. Augmented reality says, well, you start in the real world and you add digital things to it. The glasses you see now, HoloLens, you may have heard of from Microsoft, are about, you know, putting a substantial piece of kit on your head, but be able to see through it, see your real world, but then have information put on walls that only you can see, or, you know, kind of playing games on your coffee table and stuff like that. And I think that one of the things that makes this stuff mainstream, and one of the things that I think is really interesting, is about, I used to talk about the boring things, so directions, you know, doing your banking, things like that, where you rely so much on digital information to, you know, these days to find where you're going. Having that overlaid on the street in front of you as you're walking, super useful.
I think it is important though to note at this point that in the industry to slightly devolve the headset from virtual and augmented reality, just because of late it has almost come to mean the same thing, but actually it's not necessarily. Even something like Pokemon Go, which was just phone based, I mean, it's arguable how truly augmented that was, but it was a form of augmented reality. And similarly in manufacturing space, in fact, for years and years they've been talking about using virtual reality in projection environments. So it could be big rooms with huge screens on the walls with 3D projection capabilities. So it is there's actually a range of technologies in there that are different possibilities.
Absolutely. And the thing that, you know, to answer your original question, that I'm working on how that stuff has impact, and the thing that has kind of that delivers virtual reality, augmented reality now predominantly is game engines. So I work on game engines to look at how these real-time rendering things, so you go to the cinema, you see an amazing virtual character, you know, if you see a superhero movie, you know, you can play a video game on a modern console. They're all generated in real time to kind of high fidelity, and virtual reality relies on that. And so I'm looking at where those technologies become more merged into broadcasting, more merged into our daily lives. And that's for me like a huge impact, is because as those technologies get better, it unlocks, you know, ever more kind of interesting applications of 3D. So you'll hear and read about the end of 2D and the beginning of 3D, and I think that's the real revolution, is that thinking in three dimensions, working as humans in three dimensions, experiencing in three dimensions stories, is a move beyond the flat screen.
But Zilla, I mean, there's such a range of possibilities here, from sort of quite boring stuff like banking to amazing sort of high-tech experiences. From the point of view of the BBC, where should we really be looking for the best way forward in this, do you think?
Well, I think in many ways it's too early to say and to bet on any one thing, so that it really is important to keep exploring different genres. But the possibilities for learning are enormous, and for really creating exciting learning opportunities that take you to a place to see what it's like there, or enable you to experience somebody doing something with you there with them. So that will be very significant.
And that's well within the BBC's remit.
Absolutely,
isn't it?
That's totally within public service remit. There's been enormous exploration within news generally across the industry. I think partly generated by journalistic curiosity, because journalists like to tell stories, and foreign reporters particularly are compelled by the idea of being able to actually take people there to see what a situation's like themselves, to put the audience in their shoes, to look around and experience what it's like. And again, once the technology gets a little bit better, and it does need to, the idea that you could be with a reporting some extraordinary scenes from, for example, the Arab Spring, it could be an incredibly intense experience to watch as a viewer.
But let me ask all of you this, because it seems like there are all sorts of pretty interesting possibilities. But in order for a mass audience to experience them, in a media context at least, we need people to invest in kit to headsets and so on, and maybe even expensive computers. Don't we really need one thing to be absolutely indispensable, a killer app to drive this revolution, do you think, Becky?
Excellent question. I think people talk about the killer app a lot. Sometimes I'm a bit sceptical about whether or not it's one single thing, or it's a greater volume of high-quality applications. Like I said at the beginning, it's the variety is also key as well. I'm not sure if we're looking for just one killer app or a variety to show that this is such a versatile application.
It could be one kind of killer type of app, I suppose.
Yeah, and maybe a sort of killer industry, potentially, I think. But yes, I mean, everybody, I think, in the industry recognises that we are at this early chicken and egg stage with technology improving, content starting to improve and diversify. But the investment in content to date is still relatively low across the industry. And I think everybody, I've read a lot of surveys that show that people think that the lack of content is holding it back at the moment. So I think people need to keep experimenting. It's early. We can't de-risk the fact that people don't have these headsets in their homes right now. But the experimentation is really important.
No, it is. And I was at the Imperial War Museum this Saturday, very hot day, showing people We Wait, which is one of the BBC experiences, which actually both Becky and Si worked on, which shows you what it's like to be on a beach meeting a family of migrants who are just about to take the journey from Turkey to Greece. Not many people are going to be able to see that in their homes, but they can through museums and exhibitions, and we'll have to work hard to increase audiences' appreciation and understanding of VR and work out what content works through unusual things like that. But I find it really useful to think back to the early days of broadcast history, be it radio or be it the early days of the BBC television service, where you start with an hour, you've no real idea what works, you start with something very theatrical in the first few days of the television service, and you work from there. And when television started broadcasting in the UK, the audience was tiny and people had to go to Selfridges to watch it. And we're at that sort of stage where we're working it all out. We must just be patient.
Well, OK, we've got a couple of questions from our audience, actually. Anthony Martin says, is the key to VR success in mobile devices rather than tethered to expensive PCs or Macs? And if so, how long until mobile is capable? And then Caroline Anstey asks, when do you think VR will be part of our everyday social media experience? 5 years, shorter or longer? Si, do you want to have a go on that?
Well, it's interesting. So the big games conference, the E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, took place last week. And the Microsoft didn't show any VR, and it was a notable exception. Why didn't Microsoft show any VR at their games conference, given that Sony have a headset? And they said it's not going to be viable until it's untethered. So even a mainstream games company who have an audience who are willing to pay hundreds of pounds to get these kind of experiences and be first and be early adopters, they weren't even going to bet on that unless it was untethered. And I think that's I think that's right. I think we have to look at when it becomes convenient to be portable, when it becomes convenient to have in a bag, pull out and be powerful off. As to kind of when it becomes social, we talked about the killer app, and I think in any technology, as Zilla alludes to over time, the thing that makes a difference in technology is people. So, you know, radio was another person talking to you in your room. Television was looking at other people. The internet is communicating with other people. And now we reach a point of being able to experience something with other people. And as Becky talked about with the Star Trek bridge crew example, when that works, it's magic. It's not every day. It's not all tied together and kind of as simple as flicking a switch and having it happen. But when it is, I can't see how be here with me isn't a thing that people are going to want to do an incredible amount with, whether it's for entertainment or whether it's just to catch up with family. I think when it involves people, it will be transformative. And will it be 5 years? I think you could argue it might be.
Becky, what's your take on these questions we've been sent?
I would say that I think we should all recognise that we don't yet know what devices we're designing for right now. The things that we're seeing, that we've seen come out over the last year are hugely exciting and have let a lot of people try some really interesting new applications and new content. But just because we're not designing for the devices as they may be in 2 to 5 years' time doesn't mean that all this experimentation isn't incredibly valuable. We can still learn how to make stories, how to make other business applications, how to create the production tools that you need to make it, because they don't just exist. People are adapting things all the time and creating new workflows, new production workflows that didn't exist before. So all of this stuff we're doing right now will be directly applicable in the future.
Okay, I'd like to end, if we could, with a bit of sort of career advice. People listening to this who would like to move from whatever field they're in now into VR, what would be the kind of background, and what could they do to make themselves qualified to get a foothold in this world?
Well, interestingly, the newsrooms I spoke to, there's some sense that photojournalists have the best eye for this, probably better than video journalists, because they're used to framing one picture that tells the whole story, and so whereas in video journalism, of course, news cameramen quickly take a series of shots to put together a package. So you do have to think differently. You have to think spherically. You have to look all around you when composing a shot, and you have to think about a slightly different, more experiential form of storytelling, where you hand over control to your viewer to look at what they find interesting in that scene that you've given them, which also has interesting repercussions for the sort of way we report on television, which is somebody standing up in front of a camera and explaining things. So I'd just encourage people to watch all they can, and be willing to sort of reinvent the way you tell stories, and think now as much as possible about making that experience interesting for the audience.
Becky, what would your advice be?
I think VR is a very making any VR is a very multi-skilled project. It requires a lot of different people with different skill sets, and I think we were talking recently, Zilla, about the role of a producer in this, or I've sometimes heard it be called a VR generalist, but somebody who can understand how to bring these skills and these people together, because you're often borrowing bits from, say, a film production or from a games production background, and being able to look across a whole project and see who you need and bring them together is actually a real skill, and I think something that we're going to need a lot more of, whether it's for creative content or for business-facing content. I think that role is going to become really important.
Well, it's great to know there are some new media jobs on the horizon anyway. Well, thanks very much, everybody. My thanks to Zilla Watson, Cy Lumb, and Rebecca Gregory-Clark. To find out more about VR and 360 video, please go to the Academy website, and please follow us on Twitter and Facebook at BBC Academy. This podcast was produced by Chris Bramwell and Roxy Ibrahim Khan. From me, Charles Miller, thanks for listening and goodbye.
You've been listening to the BBC Academy podcast. If you want to find out more about this topic or to hear previous shows, search online for the BBC Academy.